Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the On Air podcast. On the last week, on the 15th of September, it was the 50th anniversary of King Carl Gustaf of Sweden coming to the throne. It was his golden jubilee. So, obviously, as we do with all amazing jubilees, we thought we'd have a rundown of our highlights of the sort of jubilee celebrations, and also just give a little bit of background on sort of who Carl Gustaf is anyway.
So it was also this year the 500th anniversary of Gustav Vasa becoming king of Sweden. He's a very important figure in Sweden because at the time Sweden was part of like Norway and Denmark, and he was sort of, he helped to liberate Sweden and then was elected as the king. So he's a very big figure. So it was just coincidental that it was like 50 years of Carl Gustav and 500 years of Gustav Vasa. So they made it a big thing. And I think one of the things I liked before we even really get into the actual stuff that happened is that since February, the king and queen have been doing tours of all of the kind of traditional areas, the traditional counties of Sweden. And I know we've talked about this in previous things before, but I really like when they do that, because I think firstly, it means that it's present in people's minds. So just as people are starting to forget that the Jubilee year is happening, oh, they pop up and they're somewhere else. But also, you know, in every country, it's very different in Stockholm from how it is far in the far north of Sweden. You know, it's a very long country and it's very different in those two areas. Just like it's very different in London from how it is in Aberdeen, where I'm from. So I think it's a nice idea to kind of make sure that you're seen in every part of the country.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's an easy way for lots of people to see you and feel like they've had a part of the celebration. Because obviously, you know, not everyone is going to get to Stockholm on the Jubilee weekend to do anything, and a lot of it is, you know, as is any good Jubilee, very military based or diplomat based. So it's not for the ordinary person to kind of like jump in and dance in. Whereas these are things where, you know, you could be like, oh, when I was your age, my great grandchild, I met King Carl Gustaf on his 50th Jubilee year, and I was part of that.
Yeah. But then the major celebrations this week kind of kicked off on the 13th. There's lots of things that happen around this, the royal stuff. So there's like a guest book that you can sign, and there's buildings that are open for free and you can go and visit and all that sort of stuff. But in terms of the stuff the royals actually did, the king received an official gift from his household and also one from the government. So the gifts were from his household. It was a monogram that was added to the railings outside the palace. In the gardens, and from the government, it was a work of art that was inside the palace, like a tapestry thing, and it's on the staircase that tourists go up and down. You know, I think it's a nice thing, and you know, it's nice that it kind of, they're in places where they can be enjoyed by the public. And I do sometimes wonder if Carl Gustaf's like, I mean, this is a nice tapestry, but I did want a quad bike, you know.
Yeah, I was really sort of fascinated by the fact they got a gift from the palace staff.
Yeah,
because I'm sure it's a cultural thing, and I'm sure, you know, Carl Gustaf was like, oh, this is really nice, but it fascinates me. And I also want to know who decided, like, were they like, right, we've got a kitty, if you want to donate to the king's birthday present, can you give me £10 and sign the card, please? Or, you know, like, is it like when you're trying to organise a work birthday present and everyone's like, I'm chasing you off on that £10, they're going, I never agree £10, I agree £5, like, what is the deal here? I need to know.
They do that a lot of my work, where it's like every other week, basically, there's an email that goes round that's like, such and such's birthday's coming up, contribute to the fund for their birthday and sign the card. And I'll always sign the card, but I do have a thing of like, if I know that somebody gets paid more than me, I don't contribute financially because I'm like, well, they already get paid more than me. That's their gift. Why do I have to give money? So it's a bit like that. I'm like, I feel sorry for like, somebody who works in the kitchens or something who's like, I don't know, minimum wage or whatever, and is having to buy a gift for the king.
Yeah, I'm really bad at gifts at work. The worst one is birthdays, because my birthday's in the summer holidays. Who's never going to get a birthday present on their birthday? Me. So I feel like I don't need to contribute here. I'm not part of this gang.
So yeah, then we moved on to the 14th, which was where there was a Jubilee opera performance. I think the most notable thing about this is that this is when we started to see other heads of state and other royals coming in attendance. In terms of royals, we had Queen Margrethe, Crown Prince Frederick, and Crown Princess Mary from Denmark. We had Queen Anne Marie, who's kind of like honorary Danish. She's the sister of the Queen of Denmark, but she is also the Queen of Greece, or was. From Norway, we had King Harald, Queen Sonja, and Crown Prince Haakon. His wife, Crown Princess Mette Marit, was due to attend, but she wasn't able to because she's taking a couple of weeks off sick. You can go and listen to our Mette Marit episode, Little Miss Sunshine Optimism, where we explain about her illness and why that's a thing. Other than that, there was sort of other heads of state from the Nordic countries, but they're not monarchs. So like the head of state of Finland, you know, that kind of thing, were there. I did see a lot of people questioning why it was so small and why it was just kind of the Scandinavians. But to be honest, I wasn't expecting any more than that, because if you look historically, like they did a big celebration for his 40th anniversary 10 years ago, which is not standard Jubilee, but they did it anyway. It was a similar situation where there was only sort of like the Nordic heads of state who were who were there. And then they tend to save the big invitations for their birthdays. So like if it's for the king's 70th birthday, every royal family sent somebody.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think if you think back at the last sort of 10 years of big royal gatherings, they are predominantly from every country, sort of weddings, birthdays and funerals.
Yeah.
But because I think we've had so many jubilees sort of in the last couple of years, we've merged them together. Not we, personally, as us. We as in the society have merged them together into there was a big event with royals and it was a jubilee year. C'est la vie, it's the same thing. Whereas in fact, they were two different events. It just happened to be very close at the same time.
You know, it was nice to see kind of the main people who you would expect to be there, I suppose, or who I would expect to be there for that event. And it was followed by a supper at Drottningholm, which is the place where they predominantly live. We didn't get to see anything from like the inside of this. It was a private thing, but we did get to see their arrivals. I think I'm not wrong in saying that there was one little guest. His arrival stole the show. Princess Estelle, who is the granddaughter of the king, she's the second in line to the throne, and she is 11 years old. She was there with her little brother, Prince Oscar, and she wore a dress which is from H&M and was actually her mother's dress that she first wore about 2.5 years ago. If you take a step back, I'm freaking out about an 11-year-old wearing a dress to her grandfather's birthday party, which is a weird thing to say, but it was very exciting.
I couldn't get over how much a tiny ball gown suited her. Like, she's 11, she's a child, and she was wearing a full-on ball gown. It was such a perfect dress because it was her mum's, and it's stunning, and, you know, it works for the regality of the crown princess wearing it. But also because it's like green and tulle and, you know, fluffy, it also works for an 11-year-old girl when you scale it down a bit.
I mean, this is not unique to the Swedish royal family, but they're particularly strong in kind of sharing clothes. So like Estelle has been wearing items that her mother wore, or her aunt Princess Madeline wore, since she was a baby. And also Crown Princess Victoria wears her mother's dresses a lot from like the 80s and things. So I think I'd always expected Princess Estelle to wear a lot of her mother's clothes because she'd always done that as a little kid. But I think maybe I thought the gowns will come when she's like 16 or, you know, starts going to things more regularly. I didn't expect at 11 that she'd be wearing this version of her mother's dress. So it was like, it was very in keeping with them and who they are and how they do things, but it was still like a nice little surprise.
Yeah, and the fact it's, you know, H&M as well, like it's such a well-known Swedish brand. But it's also a well-known global high street brand. It worked as well, again, because she is only 11. Like, she's not wearing
Oscar de la Renta couture.
She's wearing an H&M dress, which feels just a little bit more, you know, down to earth.
I know this is really bad because they're all fast fashion and everyone, blah, 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 but I don't have the money to spend on, you know, Jigsaw and Hobbs and French Connection and all that for my work outfits. So I'm going to go to H&M and Zara. And I will always be thankful to Crown Princess Victoria for turning up to her brother's wedding in a, you know, one of the most important state occasions, wearing a tiara and an H&M gown.
Yeah, like now when you go to a wedding and wear H&M, you're like, princesses do it, it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. If it's good enough for the future queen of Sweden, it's good enough for me.
Overall, they were very kind of... Estelle was in green, which stood out a bit, but she's Estelle, so of course she is. But all the sort of senior royal women wore sort of pinky shades. Like Sylvia was in kind of a blush, Madeline was in a sort of a champagne, Victoria kind of like a salmon.
I love when people come up with different names to try and differentiate, because to me it's like, it's just pink, it's pale pink or dark pink. It's like, oh wait, no, it's salmon.
I wasn't googling, I was sitting there thinking how would I describe these shades, purely just out of my brain. I was like, that was a salmon. I was like this one's a coral. I don't know what a coral shade is, but that's what it is. This is what my brain has decided. But like, even my greater wore like florals and like pinks and reds, and it was very in sync, very cute.
I did see, I don't know if you saw this, Carrie Johnson, Boris Johnson's wife, shared a note, but it was to mark the passing of the Queen, and it was obviously the only thing that she had that was related to the Queen, but she wanted to seem like she was best friends with her, so she posted this thing, and it was like a note that was left in her room when they were staying with the Queen, I think at Balmoral, that said like, the Queen is going to be wearing ice blue for dinner or something like that. And I mean I'm probably going to cut all this out, but like, firstly, that would really confuse me, because I'd be like, okay, does that mean I should wear ice blue? Or does that mean I should wear the opposite of ice blue? So that I don't, you know, that's not help. That's just information. That doesn't tell me anything. And also, like, what if she didn't bring something that works? She's already there.
She's like, come here, run to the shop. I need, yeah,
in Balmoral,
lighter like... blue. We didn't have gowns there.
But I do wonder if like they call each other up in advance and are like, everyone's wearing pink. But anyway, but yeah, I mean, everyone looked nice, but Estelle stole the show. Then we move on to the day itself, the 15th of September. And they went to a Te Deum, which is basically just a church service to say thank you to God. That's my understanding of it. followed by a changing of the guard that they witnessed from the balcony, and a children's choir. And then, so after that, Carl Gustaf had a speech that was broadcast on television, and it was basically talking a bit about his grandfather who had died, obviously on the 15th of September, the day that, so, you know, it's not just marking the occasion as his jubilee, but it's also marking 50 years since the death of his grandfather. And kind of, it was mostly a reflection on, like, the progress of Sweden over the last 50 years and how it's become sort of a very modern, forward-thinking country with great businesses and economic prospects and all that sort of stuff. It was nothing shocking, but it was a good enough speech, did what it needed to do for the occasion.
He was very much like, thank you for, you know, letting me be, I'm so grateful for being the monarch. Thank you for your trust in me. I do not mean this in a negative way, but it's a very kind of like sycophantic speech, like, this is for you. It's all for you, people.
But yeah, so there was that went out on television that had obviously been pre-recorded. But then in terms of the actual royals, we had they had a jubilee dinner. So this was a more public dinner. No children this time. I think two dinners in a row is too much. Two gowns.
Yeah, they get tired at that point.
Yeah, fair enough. I would too. So the king gave a speech and Crown Princess Victoria gave a speech. And the king's, again, was quite standard. I think the first speech I felt was more... looking back on the progress over the last 50 years and like how Sweden has changed. This one I felt was more about like the role of being a monarch. So he talked a lot about like the privilege of being a monarch. And then he kind of had some really lovely moments about his family where he said like he couldn't have more confidence in, you know, Crown Princess Victoria and the way that she's going to do the job in the future. And he said he couldn't have asked for a better life partner in Queen Sylvia, which I thought was very sweet because he's not a very affectionate man. I'll get to that later on.
Yeah, I thought it was, I really liked his little message, like nod to Sylvia in the speech. I thought it was very sweet. And also it didn't feel out of place because even though it's not a birthday or a, you know, personal celebration, it was very much like she's been by my side as the queen. You know, she's done all of this with me. Like, it's a celebration of me, the king, but she's been there, which I thought was really nice.
So yeah, it wasn't groundbreaking, but it was a good solid speech. And Victoria also gave a speech. She called him a role model. She called him a kind of constant for her. And she used this like hiking metaphor. Where she kind of talked about like her father, she'd gone out hiking with her dad when she was little and kind of followed him and learned from that about, you know, why nature is important and that's why she cares about nature, but also kind of about following on from him and observing him and watching him. And then she used lots of like metaphors of like, you know, weather metaphors of like when you're hiking and you have to get through a storm and like important it is to have somebody who's a strong leader. And you know, it was very Scandinavian to use like hiking as a metaphor for your speech.
It was very hurt, but it was also like, I'm sure, like between them in a put like the same thing they talk about like at the family dinner table, like when they're talking around subjects, like, oh, remember when we went hiking and you did this? It was very kind of felt like that, but like in an incredibly Victoria way.
Yeah, and I mean, it seemed to go down a treat in the room because I've seen some things about how like Madeline and Sylvia and the King and all of them were like tearing up about how emotional they were about all these nice things Victoria had to say. There was also like some photographs that were released, some official photographs that kind of had like, you know, the Nordic heads of state with members of the royal family, and then like the royals, the monarchs of the Scandinavian countries and their spouses and so on and so forth. I mean, they were very nice. I'm glad they released official photographs, but I don't know if it's just me and if I'm just imagining this, but I felt like the camera was really far away from them. They look so
It
small.
was really far away because it took me ages to figure out who was in them. Like, not because I mean, I know what they look like, but I was like, and who is that man sat
Yeah,
there? Like,
to
it
zoom
just,
in.
they were really far away. But yeah, I did also think it was very funny the one where they had the sort of the heads of state and the heirs and the spouses because, like, I kept thinking, like, imagine being like Carl Philip and Madeline and it's your dad's jubilee, and they're like, can you two go stand over there, please? Frederick, cut me the
Yeah.
photo. There's only two more of them. Just shuffle them in. Come on, guys.
It's like a wedding when you're doing the photo shoots.
I went to a wedding once and I was the plus one, but of the bride's sister. So she was in so many pictures and I just kind of awkwardly stood there like, hi.
So the last big day of celebrations, the 16th. So there was a procession through the streets of Stockholm in a carriage to sort of wave to the public. And then there was a concert. It was nice to see the children again. You know, I think that's something that came out for me from lots of the different events is that we kind of had representation from Estelle and Oscar in particular. But then on this day, we also had the Carl Philip and Sophia's sons, or the two older sons, who were able to watch the procession going through the streets of Stockholm, which I think is a nice thing for people, like the people to be able to see them, because everybody likes seeing royal kids because they're small and cute and they do nice things. But also, it's probably really good for them because, like, when they grow up, they're going to have the memory of this, a very unique memory of this historic event. So, for the second part of our episode, we have decided that we were going to do a little bit more of a dive into who is Carl Gustaf. I'm obviously, my primary area of interest is the Swedish royal family, and I have, you know, a blog about Victoria, and I've got books about them and documentaries, and I read Swedish articles and all that sort of stuff. So I know a bit. I'm not an expert on anything really, but I know a bit. I know that you follow the Swedish royal family, but perhaps not as closely as I do. So I wanted to ask, before we did this episode and before you did research for this episode and things, what was your perception of Carl Gustaf, if you don't mind me asking?
It's kind of a mixed one. Like, on one hand, kind of, well, he's kind of like, on one hand, very reserved and awkward. And on the other hand, you know, incredibly quirky. Not to be like 2000s quirky and relatable, but like very eccentric. That probably is a better word for it. Like an eccentric old man that you see in a film as like a side character, but he'd be the secret fan favorite. That was the kind of vibe I had of him.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair. I think that's the general assessment of Carl Gustaf. So I thought, we thought it would be interesting to kind of go into what has made him this awkward, quirky person. So Carl Gustaf was born in 1946 to Princess Sibylla and Prince Gustaf Adolf. He was the fifth child, and he was the only son. So he has four older sisters, and so I think his birth was something that was very long awaited. And at the time, girls couldn't inherit the throne of Sweden at all. So they had nobody, basically. The girls, you know, sounds harsh, but at the time, the girls didn't really count. So they'd been waiting a very, very long time to have a little baby boy. And so the second that he was born, even compared to most sort of future monarchs, the pressure on him and the attention on him was incredibly intense right from birth.
It gave me solid, like, I don't want to say Henry VIII vibes, but like that kind of, we're going to keep having babies until we get to a son. And, you know, we're starting to age out of the being able to naturally have babies bracket. And this is a last chance saloon. And just by pure chance, they did happen to have a son. In my head, it happened in the Tudor times. Like, I know it didn't. But when I try and imagine back like to the 40s, I'm like, yes, red velvet everywhere.
I mean, that's probably fair. They do like red velvet in royal families, don't they? One of the most defining things about Carl Gustaf's life is that just 9 months after he was born, his father was killed in a plane crash. And I don't want to start a conspiracy theory, because I know that people get very sensitive about plane crashes and things like that. But there's been a lot of royal plane crashes.
No, that is exactly what I thought. I was like, why are so many attractive heirs dying in plane crashes?
Yeah, what William of Gloucester died in a plane crash. Philip's family, Prince Philip's family died in a plane crash. I suppose maybe they fly more than we do, so maybe that's why it changes. But, you know, it's just, like, I don't know anyone who's died in a plane crash. So
yeah, it was the first thing I thought when I realised, because I knew he died when Carl Gustaf was very young. But I was like, in a plane crash, another one. I'm just going to spend this entire episode starting conspiracy theories. I'm quite enjoying it.
Yeah, Grace does this a lot. You don't know that because I cut it out a lot of the time. And I should say, a lot of the time she asks me to. So it's, you know, yeah. But, you know, she does start a lot of conspiracy theories and you don't know that about her. So I'll see if I keep this one in. And also, like, I won't get into all of this, but he was with, like, somebody who was a woman who was not his wife. But anyway, I think it's interesting to lose a parent at that age because, like, William and Harry lost a parent very famously. And obviously that was incredibly traumatic for them, but they remember her. They have stories about her. And Carl Gustaf's older sisters will remember their father and have stories about him. But he was 9 months old, so he's not going to remember anything about his dad. So it's a weird thing because there's like, there is a gap. There is a feeling of loss. There is a grief, but it's all for somebody who you never actually knew.
My friend had an older brother who died before she was born. And obviously her parents were grieving him and, you know, it was a thing. He was part of the family. But for her and her younger sister, they were like, we don't know this man. Like, you know, we have no connection with him. And, you know, I remember them saying that they found it really hard to sort of separate sort of any actual feelings they had from, you know, just thinking like, oh, on this day, mum and dad are sad. So we're going to be sad because that's just what you do. But it's such a fascinating like area of humanity because people, you know, grieve for strangers all the time. But I think when you take that stranger closer to home, it becomes a lot harder to feel the same sort of just natural grief because you're like, but who were they? What was our relationship? Because they had one, but they just Carl Gustaf obviously doesn't remember that relationship being 9 months old.
I think this is one of the most interesting, but also one of the most important parts of who Carl Gustaf is right at this early age. Both him and his sister Christina have spoken about how their mother, Princess Sibylla, became incredibly lonely and really struggled, which of course you would, even if you're a royal. Her husband died and left her with 5 children to raise, one of whom was 9 months old and is the future monarch. Like, that's a huge amount of stuff to deal with on your own. And apparently she really, really struggled with it. And there's a very famous anecdote that Carl Gustaf didn't actually know that his father was dead until he was 7. But in this sort of recent interview I was watching, he not only did he not know that his father had died until he was 7, because nobody would speak about it. They did not mention his name and he didn't have any reason to know any different. You know, like, this is just the environment he was raised in. So nobody actually mentioned it. But he said that he was 13 or 14 when he found out how his father had died. And that was from newspapers. That wasn't from any member of his family. And he said from his recollection, he never spoke about his father with his mother or with his grandfather ever. And he still doesn't talk about it now. And We know that a lot of royals who were brought up in that kind of era, and a lot of his contemporaries like King Charles and things, who grew up in families where there was perhaps not as much emotional literacy or emotional conversations as there are in families today. But I think Krogstad is like a level above that. Like, his father died and he was ne it was never allowed to be mentioned ever.
It's really interesting to think about the fact that, for Carl Gustaf not know, almost like not knowing he had a dad, because he wouldn't have mixed with other people. He would have been, home educated and just spent time with his family and, the staff at the palace. So there really was no other way for him to, like, it's just wild to me to think that for him, he didn't know he didn't have a dad because there was no dad to relate to. Like, he had granddad, I'm sure he didn't call him granddad, but he had granddad, but there's no relation between granddad, dad, and you if you don't know the middle part should be there.
It must be really difficult. I don't want to sort of become too much of a kind of influencer psychologist who's like, oh, this thing causes this in your life with absolutely no evidence, because it's not that simple. But he must have, from a, from 9 months old onwards, throughout his entire childhood, the message must have been very loud and clear to him that you do not talk about difficult things. You do not talk about your emotions. You keep things to yourself. As we go through his life, that's had a really profound effect on him.
From, even from, if you think about, Kate's work with the early years and the impact those first 5 years, and in particular those first that first year has on you as an adult. And I know from my job, and I'm sure from your job, there's a lot of work about, ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, and if you have two of them, you're more, significantly more likely to end up homeless. And it's like a huge, significant, really scientific thing. Going, if you think about how much his mother must have been suffering, not only from losing her husband and having to bring up the future king in a very, in a royal environment, but also to have her husband die in such a traumatic and scandalous way, with another woman, whether, it was intentional or not, or whether Carl Gustaf would ever remember it, there would have been at some point when his sisters would have gone, about dad, and they would have been shut down. So there would have been, it wouldn't almost have just been like an absence. It would have been that kind of, whatever the opposite of attraction is, like that rejection of any kind of discussion, that real force, which I think, is really hard to break when you're older. It is going to have a huge impact. I was talking to my mum this morning, and I was asking her, like, was her dad strict, or like, did he hug, or like, who would you go to if you had a cut knee? And she was like, well, neither of my parents hugged because that's just not who they were. And I was like, my mum's not a hugger. She doesn't hug. She doesn't feel like, she doesn't enjoy it. And I was like, well, that's come from because she wasn't, I don't think she wasn't hugged growing up, but that's what it's come from. And I think, you can see it here. It's, a man who wasn't, I'm not saying he wasn't in a loving environment, but he was in an environment growing up where there was a lot of grief and pain.
And you weren't allowed to talk about it. He became heir to the throne at the age of four. When his great grandfather died, because obviously he didn't have a dad, so his grandfather took the throne and he became heir. Up until that point, he'd lived quite a sheltered life. So he's talked a lot about kind of being like a plaything for the older sisters, he dressing him up, and other than the sort of massive trauma that nobody ever spoke about, he lived quite a sheltered upbringing, and apparently that was on the instructions of his mother, who really wanted him to have as much of a normal upbringing as possible. His mother wasn't very hands-on, so his sort of biggest avenue for emotional support, or the person that he said he would have gone to if he was worried about something or upset, was his governess, Nene. But then obviously that all kind of changed when he turned four, and the king, the king at the time, died, and he became heir to the throne. Suddenly, this sort of childhood that he'd known, for better or worse, was kind of cast aside, and he was in the spotlight. And it's astonishing. He was doing like regular engagements from that point onwards. Obviously, like, a lot of the time he was with his mother, but he was like 4 years old going to very regular engagements compared to what we would consider now, or what we see now in a 4-year-old royal.
I know, like, when I was like, when I read he became heir to the throne at four, I was like, oh my God, that's so young. And then I went, well, actually, like, Prince Jacques of Monaco, became Edward III at birth.
Yeah.
I was like, but you know, we see Prince Charles fairly regularly, but it's from a distance often, and it's, you know, at a children's party or on a balcony, or, you know, with his mum and dad behind the scenes, something like we might see with Estelle today. Like, she does occasionally meet members of the public, but it's often a video that then gets released and things like that. Whereas for Carl Gustaf, it was just your everyday engagement out and about, just as a four-year-old. Like, that's insane to me. I've never met a four-year-old. You can't get them to do anything. But like, he was off doing work.
Yeah. And he's spoken about that time period and about how incredibly difficult he found it. He said that and this is something he still struggles with, but he said that he felt like he was being made into an object. Like, everywhere he went, people would look at him and take photographs of him. And he felt like he was being stared at everywhere he went. And he also said that he learned from a very, very young age that he was expected to perform. I think all royal heirs to a degree kind of will know that, you know, they're expected to do things that their friends are not expected to do. But to have like the idea of like a little five-year-old kid who feels like they're an object and who feels like everyone's staring at them all the time and waiting for them to do something wrong and that they have to pretend to be somebody they're not. That's just so sad. Like, when I was watching this documentary about him recently, and just the whole thing just made me so sad.
Yeah, that's the overwhelming kind of, you know, emotion. And it is like, of course he's going to grow up reserved. If at home you can't, you know, talk about things and there's this sort of air of silence. But then when he goes outside, he has to be, you know, an actor at the age of four. He has to not show his emotions. He can't go out there and have a temper tantrum because, you know, he wants to go home and see his sister, because everyone will see and they'll take a picture and, you know, he'll get in trouble. And it's, you know, I think today we put such an emphasis on children being able to sort of go outside and play and be children. But we still, I think, don't necessarily extend that to royal children. And I think if we go back to the early 50s, it was significantly, we didn't extend it to any children, let alone royal children, who were like the most sort of on show of them all.
And you know, it does also, I think, still impact him today that, like, he's talked about how even now he's not comfortable with the cameras and he's not comfortable with the idea of being looked at. You know, every time he's gone outside, there's an air of discomfort and there's an air of not feeling like there's just, yeah, I don't know. It just makes me really sad to think that, like, ever since he was 4 years old, he's never really, not like Estelle, who seems to really love doing engagements and thrives in those environments. Like, he seems to have just, you know, never really had the chance to kind of, yeah, to relax. He started school at the age of six. And he said that he did fit in, like, he was able to make friends. He wasn't sort of bullied or anything like that. He, you know, it was fine. But this was when one of the other big important parts of his life sort of came into play, which was his dyslexia. So they knew that he was dyslexic. But of course, this was the 50s. There was even less understanding of dyslexia than there is today. They didn't know really how to manage it and how to make it better and, you know, all the tactics that we know now. But there was also like a social stigma. So there were still people who believed that sort of dyslexia was just laziness, or that it was a punishment even from God. You know, there were some people who believed that kind of thing even in the 1950s. What I think is really interesting, and I didn't know this until this week, there were documents from the school that he went to where they said, you know, he's got dyslexia, but there is absolutely no possibility that we will ever be able to say this in public. It is important that, you know, we make sure that this information is not known to the public. This thing that was not within his control, and that impacted him really heavily, was kind of seen as something he should keep quiet about almost, and like something that was shameful.
Obviously, dyslexia is not the same stigma today as it was in the 1950s, but there is still such a stigma around, you know, people with dyslexia not being as clever because they can't read and write properly, and, you know, especially people without an official diagnosis, which is really hard to get. There's a lot of stigma about them being lazy and, you know, having messy handwriting, so it means that, you know, they're not clever enough. Just building on what we already know about his childhood, you know, to have home being a stressful place and to have work being a stressful place, and then to have, you know, going to school and you can't write what you're thinking in your head, or you can't read what they're asking you to read. They're not being really someone going, it's okay, your brain's just wired up differently, but there's other ways to deal with it. It just being like, you're a bit thick, so this is a you problem. It's, you know, people who have dyslexia, and I think a lot, oddly, a lot of royals have dyslexia. A lot of them have spoken about how sort of isolating it was because they knew they were on, sort of on a pedestal or watched more closely. And this was like such a big thing when they were children because they were the royal, but they also couldn't read.
Well, he's got dyslexia, his father had dyslexia, his oldest sister has it, and Victoria and Carl Phillips, so two of his three children, both have dyslexia. So yeah, it very much does run within the family. And I think there's a real misunderstanding about dyslexia. People think like, okay, well, you struggle to read and write. That's what dyslexia is, basically. Like, you can't read and write as well. But it also impacts speech, particularly if you're younger. So there's often people with dyslexia will be later to develop speech. They'll be slower to pick up vocabulary, and they might mix up words in their head. It's not just about writing and reading. It's also about speaking. It's essentially an information processing thing. It's a neurodivergence. So you know, it might impact you in like you forget things or you forget the word that you're trying to say. It's actually a really important thing to kind of understanding who Carl Gustaf is, because one of the things he's best known for is being awkward and saying the wrong thing. A lot of the time, it might just be because of his dyslexia. When he's being interviewed, he might forget the word and sound a bit like awkward and uncomfortable. And I also think like the impact on your self-esteem.
I know, you know, I'm a teacher, so I teach dyslexic children, and a lot of them talk about, you know, we get a lot of notes from like the dyslexia board or whoever it is, and that like they're going to be tired because it is an extra physical thing that they're having to do. Like their brain is working harder to try and sort of translate things and to put things in the right order on top of everything else every other child is doing. For Carl Gustaf, he wasn't just doing it on top of everyone else, you know, on top of everything else in his class, but also regular engagements. And you know, I don't know if they have prince classes like they have princess classes, but you know, I'm sure you have a bit of like history and this is who what Sweden is and this is what you're going to do when you're a big boy. It must have been sort of incredibly isolating at, you know, like you mentioned in terms of self-esteem, but also in the fact that he would have just been so like exhausted and worn out and not being able to spend time doing things like making friends because that takes too much effort.
Yeah, well, he said that at the time, the approach to dyslexia was to just give you more reading to do.
That's not going to help.
No, unlike with the royals now, the press would turn up at the school outside of, you know, the first day. As he's kind of mentioned earlier, it's like there's no safe environment really for him. There's nowhere that he can just kind of close the door and be who he is. He's not, his home is tense, his school is tense, his work, you know, it's a lot for, and he was six, you know, it's a lot for a little one.
It's like every time we get to the next stage of his life, I'm like, and this is also very sad.
It's
Everything is very sad.
also well, it doesn't get any better. So at the age of 13, he was sent to boarding school, which was against his mother's wishes, but there were other forces in the court and, you know, in his family who decided that it would be the appropriate thing for him to do. And again, this is not something that I knew, but he was told that the reason that he had to go to boarding school was because he'd been spending most of his time with his mother and his sisters. They felt that he essentially shouldn't be spending that much time with women. The little emotional support that he did have through like his sister Christina or his governess, he was kind of made to feel like that wasn't an appropriate thing. And the school that he went to, it was a very he said it was a very tough environment. And you know, he did settle in, and he was very good at sports and physical activities, and he made friends and things like that. But I think it's really interesting to think about the messaging that he received as a child about what being a man was and what being a king was.
You know, I feel like as not just in Britain but across the world, we know a lot about Queen Elizabeth's kind of how she was sort of brought up as a woman to be the monarch. And there's a lot of, you know, you have to be more manly and, you know, you have to be more masculine. But I think, you know, when you hear about kind of like how Carl Gustaf was sort of brought up, it's almost medieval in the kind of there is no nurturing or anything. It's all about sort of being the man, like the biggest man, the most manly of them all.
Yes, yeah, definitely. His attitude towards women is something that will come up later on. And I just wonder, you know, again, this is very pop psychology of like, ooh, this one thing happened to him in his childhood and that changed everything about him forever. I know it's not that simple, but it was very clear that the environment that he was brought up in was one that, you know, was not necessarily emotionally supportive. And the one avenue of emotional support that he did have was exclusively women. And then when he got to a certain age, he was kind of told, well, that makes you a pansy. So you have to go somewhere else to be strong and manly and do your job. And you can't talk to the women in your family. And like, that's that age as well. Yeah. So, he went to boarding school. But then after school, he went into the military. So he served in all of the branches of the military, which I think he said was a really important time for him. You know, we talked about the military before and he said that, you know, it was quite easy for him to take orders because he was used to doing that from older people in his life. Then he went to study lots of different things at university, but mostly like history, sociology, political science, the things that royals tend to study at Uppsala. And then he did economics at Stockholm.
It was really interesting when I was reading the list. I was like, how do you have time to study that many things? But I study one thing and I'm like, I can't do anything for 5 years now. I'm too tired.
Yeah, he was going to university in the sort of late 1960s. So there was all over the world, and Sweden was no exception, there were kind of countercultural movements that were springing up. There were big student protests across Sweden at the time. And amongst other things, they were criticizing the monarchy. So, you know, there were student protests. And then in the halls down the road, the king, the future king, was one of their fellow students. And there was a book that was written about King Carl Gustaf when he was about 23 years old that was essentially saying kind of what we mentioned before, because the dyslexia thing wasn't really that well known, saying that he was too stupid to be king, too lazy, too shy. He definitely probably didn't help himself, because this was also sort of the age when he started getting into like driving fast cars and going to parties and hanging out on yachts with beautiful women. And like, so his image was this kind of lazy, you know, doesn't really, not appropriate for the role, and he's not necessarily helping himself by being in the tabloids every week with a different woman.
It's such a like typical like boy royal story. Like, you know, they hit, you know, a little bit of freedom. And I think it would be the same not just for royals, I think it is the same for anyone, whether you are a future king or, you know, a goody two shoes at school who's just for the first time moved out. What? Yeah. But as soon as you sort of have that bit of freedom, you do just go like, right, what is the weirdest thing I can do while still being me, but just like me on steroids? But, you know, for most of us, it's not documented in biographies and on the national front pages. Whereas for royals, it does tend to be front page news.
You know, how much of it was just, it's fun, I like to go in fast cars, you know, and it was just a very simple thing. And how much of it was like a reaction to his upbringing? For the first time in his life, he probably wanted to enjoy himself.
Wow, you can have fun. I'm trying that.
And also just as an aside, this might be a controversial opinion, but I just wanted to talk about how weirdly attractive I found him when he was young.
Is that because I don't personally see it, but I mean, I can understand it.
I'm going to try and post a photograph of him in a swimming costume when he's young, where he's like, sorry, this is this is so unprofessional. They don't get this on Aftonbladet's, the Swedish podcast that they do. I don't like muscle, but he was like toned without being muscly, so he had a really good physique. But also he's just like, weirdly to me, especially at that young age, I don't know if it's the fact that he was with all the women and with all the fast cars, and I have terrible taste in men, but there's something very like charismatic about that. Anyway,
I mean,
we can agree to disagree.
This is a disagreement. A true disagreement happened.
Carl Gustaf finally became king on the 15th of September, 1973. He was only 27 years old. And something he's kind of said consistently over the years is that he wished he'd had more time, and that when he became king, he kind of felt that he had no experience. his family didn't ever discuss politics, which, I mean, is an absolute shocker when you know what you know about his family, that they didn't discuss politics around the dinner table. Like, he'd done a lot of engagements with his grandfather, but he also said that as much as he respected his grandfather as the king and all that sort of stuff, they weren't personally close. The queen over here, she didn't have much formal education, but she did have a very good relationship with her father. So if she asked, she had a question, she could go and ask him. And then when after he died, she had her mother, and she had Queen Mary, who had lived through like 17 billion monarchs at that point, so was very experienced. So, you know, she had people that she could go to. Whereas Carl Gustav, his father was dead. His grandfather had just died. His mother died a year before he became king. So he really was probably the least prepared monarch.
You can almost see how sort of isolating it is. And I think, you know, it's such a theme that's happened throughout his entire life, this kind of isolation and not being able to talk to anyone. And in this case, it's almost by accident, because there just wasn't anyone for him to talk to.
Yeah, I mean, he had his uncle, Prince Bertil, but that was pretty much it. Yeah, it kind of, he said since that he felt completely alone, which I don't think is surprising. I think it's a difficult time anyway when, like, somebody in your family dies and then you have to take on this massive responsibility. But, you know, he was really the only person, he was completely on his own. So,
you know, when I first heard about abdications, I was like, that's just so weird. Why would you do that? And then every time you learn about, you know, a royal who became monarch after their parents died, you're like, nope, I see why abdications are a thing. I understand.
It's just happier. But yeah, so he was king at that point, a very young, in my opinion, quite attractive, charismatic young king. Carl Gustav had been, as we mentioned, seen with a lot of beautiful young women. In 1972, a few months before his mother's death, he, and about a year before he became king, he met a woman named Sylvia Sommerlath at the Munich Olympics. She was working as kind of the head hostess, so she was looking after the VIPs. It's a very vague job, but that's what she did. And yeah, so she was working there, he met her, and then they went on to marry in 1976. And obviously it was quite a big break because she was a commoner. And she wasn't Swedish, but he was king, so he could do what he liked at that point. But I don't think I've ever really thought about it this way before, but he met Sylvia and he said, like, he always liked long, dark hair. So she was his type. But then a few months later, his mother dies. Then a year later, he becomes monarch. I'm sure they love each other and they got on with each other and all that sort of stuff. But Sylvia really came into his life at just the right moment. She was like just the right person at the right time. You know, she was confident, she was organized, she was good at hosting people and good at making people feel welcome, which is a really important part of the job. He was experiencing a huge amount of loss and change and isolation and really needed like a companion, to somebody who could accompany him so that he wouldn't be doing this completely on his own. He wouldn't be so lonely. And I feel like that's kind of the role that Sylvia has always occupied for him. It's interesting. He said in a recent interview about, the perhaps controversial decision to marry a commoner, "For once, I exercised my right to rule over myself."
Oh, that's a good quote.
It's a good quote, isn't it?
I like that.
Yeah. I think it's, yeah. You know, like marrying Sylvia was kind of like this one thing that he could do that was for himself.
One of my kind of, prior to doing my research, my views on Carl Gustaf were very much that he was a very traditional man and kept to the rules. And I think this is, you know, it is such a break for the monarch to marry a commoner who isn't even Swedish. You know, it's a lot to do. And on one hand, like, you know, there was no one to tell him no, really, because he didn't have a mum or a dad or, you know, a granddad to be like, you can't do that. But at the same time, it was in many ways, it was incredibly risky, because it could have turned the entire country, could have gone, hang on, if we're going to have a king, you better do what we want him to do and not marry, you know, a commoner from, you know, Brazil.
Yeah.
So it was a real sort of brave decision to make. And I think, like you said, Sylvia has very much taken on that role of being his companion as well as his wife. And I think, you know, I was thinking that of all the spouses to monarchs at the moment, she's the one I probably know the least about. But it works, because she still does her job and she clearly has interests, but she is supporting.
It's, you know, there's all these, not to get all gloomy, but there's all these studies about, like, if a woman is widowed, she usually still lives for quite a long time. But if a man is widowed, he usually dies pretty shortly after his wife. And it's because for a lot of men, I think particularly of his generation, their wife is everything. She's the only person that they are ever emotional with in any way whatsoever. Yeah, not to be morbid, but I think that they very much have that kind of relationship. It's somebody to share this burden with.
I think for Carl, Gustav and Sophia and Sylvia, it's a very kind of, it's a marriage rooted in, I don't say codependence because it sounds very negative, but a kind of a need for each other. Whereas, you know, for Harold and Sonia, there was a real passionate love. And I think there is a difference in the way that they kind of lived their life since.
So, yeah, he married Sylvia. I think one of the first big things to happen in his reign was on the 1st of January of 1975. So Carl Gustaf's great-grandfather was, when he was king, the king of Sweden still had pretty much unlimited power. Like, they could do it, you know, anything really. So Carl Gustaf grew up in a time of pretty rapid political change. So after his great-grandfather died, you know, throughout his grandfather's reign, it was a gradual progression of the king of Sweden losing more and more power. And then shortly after he became king, so on the 1st of January 1975, the last few remaining vestiges of power that the Swedish monarch had were removed, and he became a figurehead only. So we've talked about this before, but like, Carl Gustaf has probably the least power out of any monarch, I would say.
Yeah, very much like he is a figurehead.
Yeah.
Just that's it.
Yeah. So like over here in the UK, we, you know, we don't necessarily think of them as being political, but, you know, they sign our laws, they open our parliament, they officially, the monarch appoints our prime minister and theoretically could appoint whoever he wanted. In Sweden, on paper, they can't do them. So, you know, he can't appoint the prime minister. He can't declare war. He doesn't sign the laws in Sweden. So he very much is just like a party host. it's quite a unique position to sort of have, to be a figurehead, but to have no actual power. And so something that Carl Gustaf has got in trouble for quite a bit over his life is for saying things that perhaps he shouldn't, that are perhaps a bit partisan. So a very famous recent example was when he said that, you know, the response to COVID in Sweden had been a massive failure, essentially. And a lot of people were like, maybe you shouldn't say that because that was the government's decision and it's not really your place to get involved in that sort of partisan, potentially sensitive issue. But it's just one of many times when he's done a similar thing. And Carl Gustaf has always said that his view is, unlike all the other monarchs, like, he can't actually do anything. Like, he can't sign anything into law. He can't, you know, he has no real power. And so he thinks that as a result of that, he is free to speak as he wants. He just won't lobby. I see his logic, because he is the only one who is not, you know, the problem with the monarchs over here, or the royals over here being partisan, is that they actually do have very real power. Carl Gustaf doesn't really have that incentive to not get involved, because he, you know, as he says, he doesn't sign the law, so it doesn't really matter. He's just speaking as a person. But it would probably be wise to just not to be safe.
It feels like when I talk to the kids at school, I'm like, I understand why you think that, but you're wrong.
Yeah.
I understand his logic. I do understand it, because it does, logically, he's right. He's got no power. What? He's just a normal person, but he's also the king, and what he says has an enormous amount of sway because he's the king. So it's one of the things where you're like, someone needs to tell him that, but there's no one above him to tell him that.
In the UK, like, the Tories might do something because the monarch pressures them. I don't think the same thing would happen necessarily in Sweden, but you don't know that. He does have these regular meetings with the government, and he has the ability, I'm sure he has the prime minister's phone number. It is better to just err on the side of caution, I think.
I just, you know, it's one of these things where, like, this, obviously the removal of power was very much, in place before Carl Gustaf became king. Like, it wasn't, he didn't become king and they went, go, we better take his power away from him. Like, it was already in the process of happening. But I always think it must be one of those things where if it had been me, I'd be like, can you please put in writing that this is not my fault? Because in history, it's going to go down as my reign. And I'd be like, I didn't do it. I was not part of this. I always think that, you know, I think about anything when, like, you know, if tomorrow, you know, like Canada was like, yeah, we're leaving, you know, we don't want our head of state to be Charles anymore. Charles would be like, hang on, I've only just been head of state. I don't think you can blame this all on me, guys. People going, how bad was that first year? Why can't we find any evidence of this atrocious first? Must have wiped it from history.
Queen Sylvia and King Carl Gustaf had three children together: Crown Princess Victoria in 1977, Prince Carl Philip in 79, and Princess Madeleine in 82. Another sort of rapid change that kind of, or not rapid, another change that happened that kind of involved his role and, you know, the constitutional side of his role. And this is something that had been building up as well, but sort of late 1979, coming into effect in 1980, the line of succession was changed. So previously, women had not had a right to the throne at all. That's why there had been an issue when, you know, he had older sisters and he was the only boy. But it was changed to have gender equal succession, the first monarchy in the world to do that. And so Crown Princess Victoria became the Crown Princess over her brother, who had been Crown Prince for like 9 months or something. In his typical style, Carl Gustaf has been very vocal about not liking that this change happened retroactively and that it changed so that Victoria didn't just become, you know, after her brother, she became the heir to the throne. He said this pretty much since the 1980s. He has very consistently held that perspective. And this is another one that's interesting. Because I've said that a lot. I think I've said the word interesting about 17,000 times. But it's interesting for me just because I don't know how I feel about these things. And I often wonder if my view on this is just clouded by my general view of Carl Gustaf and I'm being really biased about it. Because I think if anyone else was like, I don't think that this woman should have been the crown princess, I think it should have been the boy, I would be like, that's terrible. But firstly, you've got to think about like what we've talked about so far. So his attitude to women that kind of came from his childhood, the attitudes that he has to his job. This was the first monarchy in the world to make this system of equal succession. So it was something that a lot of people would disagree with. But also, Carl Gustaf has kind of said that his reasoning is not that he doesn't want a girl to be the queen. It's that he believes that as the sort of guardian of the constitution, as a stickler for the constitution, it's unfair that somebody who was born as crown prince under the constitution should have that taken away from him, and that change should be made retroactively. And it wasn't done that way in other countries like Norway. And it is a different thing because they were much older. I don't think Carl Gustaf necessarily appreciates that. Like, Carl Philip didn't know that he was crown prince. But, you know, I think that his reasoning, I can understand it, but I do think that it's something that is very easy to perceive from the outside as being just sexism.
Yeah, I think this is the first thing I ever learned about Carl Gustaf. And I do think it did colour my sort of opinion of him for a very long time because I was like, it was really hard to kind of like untangle it in my brain. Because like you said, on one level it is essentially him being like, boys should be the king and girls not yet. But I think, you know, it was almost, you know, thinking about the impact changes that happened when he was a baby had on his life. Like, his life has been fundamentally shaped by things that happened when he was 9 months old. So I can understand how, even if not, you know, consciously, on a very subconscious level, being like, hang on, maybe immediately changing my 9-month-old son's life is going to have an impact in a way that we can't even imagine. It's kind of helped me, you know, but it's made it clearer to me, kind of, as I've, you know, learned more about Carl Gustaf and as I've seen him interact with his children, that there is definitely, you know, there's no tension between him and Victoria. And I think, you know, it's not, he doesn't think Victoria should be queen. It was very much I felt this was unfair because of these logical reasons in my head. And it's like, you know, it's very much like someone who is just looking at something in a completely different way than everyone else. And for him, he's looking at it in a case of, you know, regardless of them being his children, you know, this person had a role and it was taken off him, you know, for no reason. I just, he maybe has never quite made the connection with the fact they are real people and they are his children and they are representing something significantly larger than themselves.
You're right, like Victoria has said herself, like in her own words, that it doesn't impact the family and it's not a thing, it's not a big deal. So, you know, I think her word is more important than any random commentator on the internet's word. I also think like there's this attitude that people think that Carl Gustaf is just randomly bringing it up, but it's kind of what I said earlier, like if somebody asks him a question, he just answers it. And that's how he feels. So he's just going to answer it as how he feels. I do think it's maybe, he probably shouldn't say it.
Yeah, it's one of those. Stop now.
Yeah, it's another one of those Carl Gustaf situations where like, yes, he can say it. And yes, I do understand where he's coming from, but it probably is better if he doesn't. But he has like in recent years acknowledged that kind of, he probably didn't give Victoria enough praise and like, she does an incredible job. And, you know, so I think he's made a concerted effort in recent years to kind of be like, it wasn't a gender thing. It wasn't a Victoria thing. And she does, now that this is the situation and we all accepted it, she does an excellent job. So, you know, he seems to be trying to right the wrongs of some of his earlier, perhaps ill-advised comments. It's also, that thing is one of the most famous things about Carl Gustaf is this kind of, what is viewed as being a misogynistic attitude. But it's so at odds with everything else he does. Carl Gustaf has essentially built the most gender equal monarchy in the world. And it's all been through his decisions. Like, it's not through the government telling him or anything like that. So, for example, his grandchildren through his daughter, Princess Madeline, are prince and princess, which is not the case in most countries. Like, Princess Anne's children are not prince and princess because she is female, whereas Madeline's children are. Also, Prince Daniel, he took on his wife's title. She's Duchess of Vestergotland, and he took on that title, Duke, which is, again, not something that happens in the UK. And again, that's not fully within the gift of the monarch in the UK, but I'm just trying to show that, like, this is quite radical. And so it's, and Carl Gustaf was fully in charge of all of that. Carl Gustaf is a contradiction, is what I'll say. And I think this is a really good example of that, because on the one hand, he seems very traditional and has the sort of outdated attitudes towards sex and gender that men of his age would have. But on the other hand, he's a real forward thinker who built this incredibly progressive title system completely on his own that nobody else has built.
Almost, I'm not saying his comments are worse because we know who Victoria is. She's grown up into an incredible crown princess and future queen. But, you know, if she'd grown up to be rubbish,
yeah,
we might all be going, you know, well, we're a big fan of gender equality, but maybe they shouldn't have swapped it for these two, yeah. You know. I think it's the actions he's made later on in his life, the actions, you know, like you said, going through, like, giving, you know, Princess Madeline kept her title when she got married, even though her husband doesn't have one. Those kind of things, they are more, sort of a more recent example, and he's gone for the gender positive option. So I think,
over and above any other royal family.
Yeah. So I think, you know, yes, when the initial decision happened, he was against it, and I don't think anyone would disagree with that. And, you know, even now he might still think it was a bit unfair, but if the choice came out today, maybe he wouldn't have made the same decision because he's not done it since, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So obviously there were stories, and Carl Gustaf did do things between 1980 and 2010. But even if you watch documentaries in Sweden, they tend to go, okay, something happened in 1980, and then we skip straight to 2010, because that is genuinely the next most interesting thing that happens to him. So in 2010, a book came out which accused King Carl Gustaf of having an affair in the 1990s with a Swedish singer. It also accused him of visiting various underground strip clubs that were run by kind of seedy crime bosses, and that he had wild sex parties with strippers. You never expect to listen to a royal podcast and hear the word wild sex parties with strippers, do you? But there you go.
No, it doesn't often come up. But no. Here we are.
And so this book came out alleging these things. And so this generated massive international attention. And yeah, he was dubbed the Scandal King. He really, again, didn't help himself in his response to it. So there were two things that he did. One was he gave this like press conference after he'd been hunting. So he was by the forest and he was in all of his hunting gear, just very casual
such a rich man thing to be doing. And he said that he hadn't really paid much attention, but as far as he understood, the accusations were in the past and everybody had moved on. So he didn't say, no, I didn't have an affair and go to strip clubs. He just said, we've all moved on. It was a long time ago.
Stop bringing up things from the past.
He says that all the time. Like every interview you watch with him, that's like an in-depth interview. That's probably his, I don't know. It's better to think about the future are probably his most used sentences. He does not ever think about anything that happened in the past. So it's very much a Carl Gustaf thing. But one of my favorite royal moments ever, he was basically asked in a different interview about whether it was true that he'd gone to like a sex club. And his response was basically, I mean, define a sex club. Not no.
I love it.
But, well, you know, we all have a different interpretation of what a sex club would be. So I don't know. Maybe it's my favorite reaction to a scandal. Have you been to a sex club? Define sex club.
What do you mean by it? Gives me sort of like Charles's whatever lovers.
Whatever, thing. Yeah.
It's like, honestly. It's like, yeah. Sorry, I was going to say, it's like my favorite, like these non-denials. They crack me up every time.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, like, he has since denied it and said that it was lies and things like that. But he, you know, he didn't really help himself by giving these sort of interviews that never really said, no, this didn't happen. They just said, oh, we don't care that if it did or it didn't happen. So this was a massive scandal for a while, but Queen Sylvia stayed with him. I don't want to excuse people for things, but I think you see things on the internet where people get very, you know, angry about a particular celebrity cheating on their partner or whatever. And it's like, you know, nowadays we understand that there are open relationships, so there's polyamory and all that sort of stuff. And maybe that wasn't as well understood in 2010, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. Or in the 90s when he was accused of having the affair. So, you know, I guess we're not in the marriage is basically my point. Every marriage is going to have different boundaries and what is okay and what isn't okay, and who's to say that Queen Sylvia wasn't like, yeah, you can go and watch some strippers as long as you come home to me. That's the most important thing. I'm not saying that is the case, but I think there's this attitude that a lot of people have that like their boundaries and what they consider acceptable in a relationship is the standard, and everybody else has to follow that. And so if somebody doesn't, that's a bad thing. So I think in terms of the marriage side of things, it didn't seem to have impacted his marriage. Sylvia stayed with him. And we don't know whether that was something that was considered inappropriate in their marriage, whether it hurt it. We have absolutely no idea. And then Crown Princess Victoria, his daughter, got married shortly afterwards and everyone was very happy. And so it sort of all fizzled away and everyone kind of stopped talking about it for a while. But occasionally it does sort of rear its head of like, oh yes, in the English language press in particular, oh yes, this is the King of Sweden, King Carl Gustaf, who got loads of headlines in 2010 because he was accused of going to sex clubs. It feels like Swedish people and his family and the king have all kind of moved on. Like Carl Gustaf is pretty popular now.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes when you've got such a dysfunctional royal family, we just have to like throw it to some other people occasionally.
Yeah.
Like, sex clubs.
Someone else does stuff too.
But yeah, it's one of those stories where, you know, it's got everything you want for a scandal, like sex and marital disharmony. And I just imagine people coming up with it at the time and then, you know, it just, this, you know, Sylvia not reacting and the Swedish royal family just being like, yeah, either, yeah, we knew, or yeah, that didn't happen, but we don't care. And just being like, oh, come on, I came up with all of this. Where is the backlash?
Crown Princess Mette Marit had a child with a convicted drug dealer and everyone got over it pretty quickly. Sophia was a page 3 girl or the equivalent in Sweden. She posed topless. Everyone got over it pretty quickly. Carl Gustaf goes to sex clubs, got over it pretty quickly. I mean, it doesn't seem to, and I to be honest, I think that's fine. Like the more worrying thing would be if Carl Gustaf was in bed with criminals, you know, like if he, not literally, but like if he knew that the clubs that he was going to were owned by criminals and he was getting himself potentially involved in crime, that would be more of an issue to me than whether or not he's, you know, having a dalliance with a stripper. Like, that's not anything to do with me because I am not his wife.
Particularly with celebrity families, they're like, oh, you know, these two celebrities have fallen out because of this reason. I'm like, I literally don't care.
No.
Like, I'm going to invent my own. It's not like I just treat them like, you know, Sims. I'm like, well, in my head, this is what's happening, guys. So that's what's happening.
So that's kind of the main things that you need to know, I think, about Carl Gustav's life. So we've kind of talked you through it to kind of help you perhaps understand a little bit more about the image he has and where that has come from and how that links back to his earlier years. And my general view is quite complicated, I think, on Carl Gustav. That's just something that I'm saying to excuse the fact that what I'm going to say is a total ramble of nonsense. But it's complicated. It's not rambling. It's just complicated. I do think that people's view of him is lacking. I think a lot of it is projection of, like, they see his awkwardness, they see his gaffes, they see these things, and they sort of fill in the blanks of, like, oh, well, he's misogynistic, or he's cold, or he's, you know, all those things. And, you know, he's not a physically affectionate person. You will not see him, like, hugging his kids all the time. He doesn't like to talk about himself. So interviews with him are physically painful at times, because he just, even the most innocuous question, if it's anything that he feels slightly uncomfortable about, he just will not talk about it. And he can be very blunt, and he can say the wrong thing and all that sort of stuff. But I think about his upbringing. This is somebody who lost his father at 9 months old, but then it literally was not allowed to be mentioned ever. In his, he found out from the newspapers what had happened. He had dyslexia, which was something that was covered up, but that, you know, substantially impacted his development and the way that he communicated with people and the way that he thinks, and still does to this day. And I think a lot of people completely misunderstand that. And so I think part of my view of Carl Gustav, and part of why I'm fully aware of the fact that I might let him off with things that I wouldn't let other people off with, is because I actually quite relate to him in a weird way, because I'm not very physically affectionate. I'm not very forthcoming emotionally. I'm quite awkward, and I can sometimes seem a little bit blunt. But I know that I'm also somebody who's very loyal, and I love my family, and you know, I care very deeply about people. And it's just that some people show their affection for others, or their softness, or, you know, that sort of side of them in a different way from other people. And I just don't, sometimes I feel like people are a little bit mean and are like, oh, he's cold, or, you know, he's just deficient in some way because he doesn't show his emotions in the way that they would. And it's like, Carl Gustav is probably not going to tell you that he loves you. He's probably not going to give you a hug, but he will spend the entire day with you out going for a walk and swimming, playing games. And, you know, he will be physically present. That's how he shows his affection. So I do sometimes feel like I let him off with things because of that sort of personal relationship. I feel like I get him in a way that other people don't, if that sounds ridiculous, but you know what I mean?
No, it doesn't. Yeah, it definitely makes sense. My view of Carl Gustav, it's weird, because on one hand, it hasn't massively changed from my preconceived notion, but it's almost like that preconceived notion was a very shallow opinion of him. And then it's like, yeah, he is reserved and eccentric, but he's reserved and eccentric because he had an incredibly isolating childhood and has experienced a lot of trauma. He doesn't fit. It's not even that he doesn't fit the stereotypical royal, because actually, of all the royals, he's probably the most stereotypical of them all, like, reserved and slightly puts his foot in his mouth a bit and is very traditional in lots of ways, but occasionally just does stuff that he wants to do and twists things because he thinks he can, because he's the king and he can. And I think something you said, like, lots of people, like, view him as a, like, kind of an oddball.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people get, you know, they have their favourite royals or favourite celebrities, and then they view everyone in a prism based on who they like. And if you think about, you know, the most popular royals, they tend to be women, and they tend to be nurturing mothers. You know, it's Victoria and Kate and Mary and Sophie and that sort of mould. So Carl Gustav is not that. He's not a nurturing mother figure in any way, shape or form, but he is, you know, he is a family oriented man. He has a passion for driving fast cars, you know, he has a passion for Sweden, and he just shows it in a different way than, you know, than really sort of flourishes in a social media age. It's a very traditional way of approaching things. And you know, I think going back almost like to what I said earlier, he does very much feel like he's born out of his time. And in you know, the 1800s, he would have been identical to all the other monarchs because they were all reserved and had, you know, incredibly traumatic family lives and weird things happened. Whereas now he stands out because he's one of the only ones who went through what he's been through.
Yeah, he said a very interesting thing in an interview recently where he said, when you are a leader, you shouldn't show yourself as weak. And I think because of his particular upbringing, Carl Gustaf probably views any kind of openness and emotionalness as weakness. And I understand that. And so, you know, that's why I sometimes feel a sense of protectiveness towards this man who is significantly older than me and probably doesn't care at all about me whatsoever. And, you know, there are really great positive things that I really like about Carl Gustaf. Like, he's very funny. And when you're having, by all accounts, whenever you have a sort of direct conversation with him, he's very easy to talk to. And I like that he's quirky and that he doesn't always think about things in the same way as other people. I really enjoy that because it could get quite boring having the same mold of people all the time. But he's a bit of a weirdo, and I always appreciate when they're a bit of a weirdo. And, you know, he does his job incredibly well. He's, you know, incredibly dedicated. He's always out working for Sweden. He's got a really full plate of work ahead, you know. He, even at his age, you know, he's really dedicated. So it's like there's lots of good attributes and there's lots of things that you can sort of say as an explanation for why he is the way that he is. But at the same time, you can't blame somebody's upbringing forever. You know, he's in his 70s. Like, at what point do you kind of say, no, it's actually on you to stop saying that you don't think that your daughter should be queen, you know? he has made mistakes, and I think I need to be better at probably saying that. He's just a contradictory kind of person. He's got so many, he's a person, he's a complex human being. You know, he's got lots of these negative traits and lots of these positive traits. I just think that sometimes people view neutral traits as being negative because they're not things that they're familiar with. And that's why I feel a certain protectiveness over him. My overriding impression of Carl Gustaf is, like, just as you feel you've started to get to know him, he slips out of your grasp. Like, he'll shut down, or he'll stop answering questions, or he won't say how he really feels about something. And I think that's the overall impression I have of him, is just like, he's a person who you can only ever get so close to. He's always going to be closed off, and that's just the way that he is. And you kind of have to accept that. But it almost makes him more interesting to me because you don't know these things about him.
He is, you know, incredibly sort of fascinating as a figure. And, you know, he's never going to be my favourite monarch. But, I mean, I have a soft spot for Charles, and he's significantly more controversial, so I really can't talk.
Yeah.
Like, no, all, you know, monarchs out there have done or said something controversial or done something that doesn't quite, you know, fulfill these sort of high expectations that people have of them. And, you know, I think in the grand scheme of things, Carl Gustaf hasn't done that many, you know, bad things.
He could be worse.
He's made a lot, he could be a lot worse. I always, you know, I always very much defer to, you know, the people of Sweden and, you know, his family. And even in Sweden, he's not, you know, universally beloved, he's still kind of significantly well liked. And I think that's always very telling, because monarchs aren't always well liked in their country.
Definitely. And you're right. Like, even though we've spent this entire podcast episode talking about our opinions on Carl Gustaf, the most important opinion is the people who are in the country that he reigns over, and they all seem fine with him. So, end of comment, end of podcast.
That's it.
Thank you for joining us for this episode this week. We hope that you learned something new about King Carl Gustaf. We probably won't have an episode next week because I have overbooked myself with various unpleasant tasks that I have to do. But I'm sure we'll be back the week after. And if anything exciting happens, we will probably do something short. So, yeah, but other than that, rate us 5 stars, follow us on Instagram, and we'll see you soon. It is a goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.